This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and thank you for joining us on our radio Main Street all across North Dakota this time of day. Today, we begin our show with a discussion of health care and nursing with somebody who knows a lot about it, Mary Wakefield, a Devil's Lake, North Dakota native who has gone on to really great things in the profession of nursing. She has her doctorate in nursing, and she is one of five living legends so named by the American Academy of Nursing. She joins us by phone from Grand Forks, where she's a visiting scholar, among other things. Mary, thanks for being with us today.
It's a pleasure, Doug.
Well, what is it like to be a living legend?
Well, what a great question. Let me say that it is an honor to be recognized by the profession that I chose to be part of decades ago. So it's a very nice honor from the American Academy of Nursing.
Were you surprised by it?
I was, because, and certainly still am, because it... This award is the highest award for a nurse to receive that is given from within the nursing profession. So it's from peers, and that's probably particularly nice, at least for me, to receive recognition from colleagues from across the country.
Well, yeah. You'll be recognized by the American Academy of Nursing in October when you actually receive the award. And your resume, as I mentioned, is distinguished. How did your medical career get started?
It started in my hometown in Devil's Lake. When I was in high school, I worked as a nurse's aide at our local hospital. And that was really an interesting experience for me, Doug. I have to tell you, I was just dazzled in that hospital in Devil's Lake. I was not dazzled by the technology back then because it was not nearly as pervasive as it is today. But what really struck me as a nurse's aide was the top flight, really personal, compassionate care that was given to every single person who came through those doors. And that care was particularly impressive from the nurses with whom I worked most closely in that small rural hospital. So experiencing that and seeing the difference that those nurses made and the incredible intellect and caring that they brought to patients and families was really the driver for me to pursue this particular career. And that was a long time ago. I'm still pleased to say that I find nurses doing exactly the same thing, of course, in hospitals and a lot of other settings across the country today.
Well, you went on to get your doctorate in nursing. And what does that entail in terms of where did you go and what did you want to specialize in terms of your dissertation?
So I pursued that doctoral degree in nursing at the University of Texas at Austin, and I tell people that I commuted to to that educational program because at that time it was a summer's program. That is, you could take intensive coursework during the summers, and for people who had faculty position in other locations, that allowed them to do exactly that, to both teach during the regular academic year and then also pursue higher education, in this case a doctoral degree. So during that time, I was actually teaching at the University of North Dakota from September through May, and then I would commute down to Texas and pick up very intense coursework through the summers for a number of summers in a row, and then ultimately graduated in 1985 with that PhD and that doctoral degree in nursing.
And your specific interest in terms of, pursuing the doctorate, what did you want to do?
Well, it's interesting because I pursued that doctorate with an eye towards staying in academic work. I was practicing as a clinical nurse locally in a hospital on weekends, but my primary job was teaching and in a management position at the College of Nursing at the University of North Dakota. And it was really my intent at the time to stay in academe throughout my career. I enjoyed practicing clinically, and I very much enjoyed teaching that next generation of mostly North Dakota nursing students. But then that shifted. There was a point in time where I took it an entirely different direction, but my doctoral degree and my dissertation very much focused on nursing faculty work and on education administration.
Well, you were former associate dean at UND, as you mentioned, and the director of UND's Rural Assistance Center. You're currently a visiting scholar at UND and at Georgetown University and the University of Texas at Austin, so you got a pretty full plate. But let's go back to that Rural Assistance Center? What's its mission? Who does it serve?
Well, so the Rural Assistance Center, it was a major initiative that we were able to stand up when I was directing the Center for Rural Health and working as the Associate Dean for Rural Health at the School of Medicine and Health Sciences at UND. The Center for Rural Health had when I was there, and still does today, a range of different programs. When I was there, directing the center, I was really focused on doing what we could to strengthen and support healthcare delivery for rural populations across the state of North Dakota, but also to be a resource more broadly across the Northern Plains region, and then to have a national contribution as well to rural health. So the Rural Assistance Center, which the name has now changed since it was first established when I was there at directing the Center for Rural Health, but the Rural Assistance Center is really the go-to place for health information about rural populations, rural health care delivery, a whole array of information that's available via the internet. And when I moved back to North Dakota to take that job directing the Center for Rural Health, I had a pretty clear sense that we had great expertise in our state in rural health care. And now with the internet, we could leverage technology to share that expertise across the nation. So that is the purpose of the Rural Assistance Center. And I'm really pleased to say that even after I left the Center for Rural Health, that has been a very strong program funded by the U.S. federal government consistently from the time I was there all the way through to today. So in other words, the Center for Rural Health, Rural Health Information Hub, as it's known now, is a resource of rural health information. It's the very best as far as I'm concerned. And obviously the federal government thinks that's true too because it's continued to fund it. It's a great leveraging of technology and North Dakota expertise.
Well, the University of North Dakota, of course, has the medical school. It has the Indians into Medicine program, and it's in a state that has a very rural population in over much of its territory. Rural hospitals in this country and some in the state of North Dakota are under stress, aren't they?
They are. It is concerning, that's for sure. Probably since about 2010, we have seen now about 106 rural hospitals across the United States closing. And a large number of those closures, frankly, have occurred in just the last few years. So the numbers of closures are not decreasing. They're not leveling off. They've actually increased. They've ticked up a bit over the last few years. Some of those, there are a number of reasons for those closures. As you look at what's going on in rural communities across the country, in some cases, the populations of some communities are really dropping significantly. And so it's difficult to sustain a rural hospital. In other cases, it is that hospitals have large numbers of people who are uninsured and unable to pay their bills, for example, when they come to that rural hospital. And, you know, just like in North Dakota, rural communities across the country look out for their neighbors, their friends, and that means that patients and people get seen typically when they need care, regardless of whether or not they can afford to pay for that care. And that's particularly challenging for rural hospitals. So I've just mentioned two of what are really a number of challenges that face our rural hospitals, and that is disconcerting. The last point I would also say is you're seeing a larger trend away from inpatient care. That is, people getting higher intensity services, maybe in their home, being discharged more rapidly from the hospital, where I used to take care of patients with cataract surgeries for a few days in a hospital. Patients aren't going to hospitals at all for cataract surgery today. So in other words, there's also been this big shift away from inpatient hospital care and trying to manage patients more effectively where they would actually like to be, and that is in their own homes, for example. So all of those and many other factors are contributing to a downward pressure on rural hospitals. Reimbursement is another issue, too, by the way.
Well, we're going to get into some of this. I was just remembering that my mother had cataract surgery years ago. It was done in a couple of hours. She went home, and her vision was wonderful as a result of that. And just last week or so, somebody I knew had laparoscopic appendicitis surgery, went home the same day.
And at the start of my career, Doug, so in one generation of a nurse, that has been a complete change, a wonderful change, because of tremendous expertise of healthcare providers and new technology, a great partnering of the two. So you see exactly what you've just described over and over, and those are starkly different from the days when I first began my practice, where that patient who was being treated surgically for appendicitis would have been in the hospital for at least 2 to 3 days before discharge. And now you see exactly what you've just described playing out in communities across North Dakota, where surgeries like that are being done, and across the United States. That's really exciting.
How would you characterize the state of healthcare in our country today? I mean, we just talked about some amazing stuff, but there's a pocketbook issue here as well.
There is. We have real challenges in managing through the cost of health care, and that hits a lot of different pocketbooks. It hits the pocketbooks of state government when health care costs rise. It hits the pocketbook of the federal government, that is Medicare program, for example, paying out more as health care costs rise. It hits the pocketbooks of individual patients and their families as well. And so the affordability of health care, as you mentioned, is a real challenge. Some of those issues for some people have been addressed through the Affordable Care Act, but there were still large pockets of individuals who continue to have challenges with affording health insurance coverage. And we know that health insurance coverage, having health insurance, makes a difference in terms of people accessing health care in a timely fashion. So affordability is a big challenge. And then there are also some rural-urban divides that concern me a lot in terms of health care. We can talk more about those or not, Doug, depending on what you wish.
Well, you mentioned the Affordable Care Act. That's been a political football since it was enacted, and there's still a lot of turmoil around that. We've got political campaigns underway now where health care is an issue out there. If you were advising a candidate about health care, what would you advise?
Well, I would say a couple of things. First, do no harm. In other words, avoid positions and policies that decrease access to health care, that could adversely impact the quality of care, or policies that could drive up the cost of health care. So aim for policies that don't damage, that is, that do no harm to access, quality, or cost of health care. So that would be the aim, first and foremost. More specifically, if I were advising people who are working in health policy, whether they're running for elective office or they're implementing programs at state or federal or even community levels, I would say in terms of that access to care, ensuring that people who already have health care challenges, perhaps diabetes or arthritis, or a particular disability, that health insurance coverage remains intact and affordable for those individuals with pre-existing conditions. To me, that's absolutely fundamental, that people have access to health care, that they have access to the drugs that they need when they have chronic conditions. Because we know too often what can happen if those chronic conditions spiral out of control. Again, whether that's diabetes, heart disease, or any number of other conditions. So really important to do no harm first with policies, and instead look for opportunities to strengthen access to care, to strengthen care quality, and to drive costs down.
Well, those chronic conditions are one issue. Acute conditions are another. We recently had a story from NPR about an issue in rural states like North Dakota, where when an emergency arises, the immediate need is like a helicopter to get that person to an actual hospital. And that helicopter ride may not be covered by insurance.
Well, that's right. And what's the fundamental concern there is, of course, the cost. But what's behind that also is looking for ways that we can maintain access to healthcare services, particularly for people who reside in rural areas. You have car accidents that can be lethal if people aren't able to get to extremely important health care in very short periods of time. And that makes ambulances and air ambulances critically important to be able to transport those individuals. So making that care accessible and seeing transportation as a part of that healthcare infrastructure is really important, particularly for rural populations and rural communities. It's part of the reason why a lot of us have a concern when we see rural hospital closures, because what has to often happen first is to stabilize that patient even before transfer, and that transfer has to be affordable. And yet we know that air transportation is expensive. It certainly is more expensive typically by quite a bit than ground transportation. But frankly, air transportation can be the difference between life and death. So that has to be there. That has to be affordable. And exactly what you've described as a problem, that is really high costs and surprising medical bills for those services, has become a high visibility issue across the nation recently. And again, in no small part because people in rural communities not infrequently depend on transportation to get access to care for emergent conditions.
So this might be something where the government might play a role in mitigating the cost of that, because a $40,000 bill to save my life might be nothing to me at the time, but might affect the rest of my life.
Well, we sure want people to be thoughtful about how they're spending their resources on health care. But as a nurse, I can tell you that my preference is that people focus on what keeps them healthy and what gets them healthy first. And generally, when people are facing an illness, if it's an acute illness that comes on suddenly, like an injury, or it's a chronic illness, like, as I mentioned earlier, diabetes or congestive heart failure, for example, I really want to make sure that people focus on getting healthy and staying healthy. And too frequently, the cost of healthcare can prevent people from pursuing the health services that they need to stay healthy or to get healthy. The research, Doug, is really clear on that. People don't seek screenings and preventive health services, that is, tests for things like prostate cancer or breast cancer, if they have high out-of-pocket costs that are difficult for them to afford. We don't want that barrier standing between an individual and the health care they need. That is that lack of affordability. That's the reason why health care costs have really got to be brought down, made affordable. Federal government has a role in that, but they're not the only ones that have a role in that.
Well, Dr. Wakefield, you serve as co-chair of the National Academy of Medicine's Consensus Study on the Future of Nursing 2020 to 2030. What do you see for the future of nursing?
One of the areas that we're really focused on in that work at a national level is seeing how nurses can be deployed a little bit differently. So, for example, Doug, nurses can the beauty of the nursing profession. There are lots of things that really excite me about the nursing profession as a career path for men and women. But one of the beauties is that nurses have many career paths they can go down. Most choose to practice clinically and might do that for their entire life. Time, but a lot of nurses pursue lots of other administrative, research, academic positions, other positions as well. But in this particular case, with the Future of Nursing report that we're working on and will complete toward the end of next year, the end of 2020, we're really focused on something that we want all nurses to focus on more explicitly. And that's an area referred to, it sounds kind of archaic, but we refer to it as the social determinants of health. And let me just say what that means. We know that what goes on, for example, in doctors' offices and in hospitals makes a big difference to a patient and a family's health. But we also know that what goes on outside the bricks and mortar of hospitals and clinics has a very big impact on the health status of an individual or a family or even a community. We know that if individuals are living in poverty, if individuals are unable to access health care, if individuals have lower rates of formal education, we know that in those cases, their health actually can be impacted. And so the focus of this report and our work on this report is to really better understand how nurses can step back and engage with patients and their families around those other precursors to health. That is, if they are insecure in terms of their ability to access healthy food, if their housing isn't a healthy environment, maybe there's they're living in an apartment building that still has lead paint and they're raising a small infant, for example, we're really stepping back and looking at those environmental factors, a patient's socioeconomic status, and so on, that can impact their health beyond just what goes on in a hospital or a clinic, as I mentioned, and then trying to determine what else nurses can do to work with patients around those particular needs. In fact, a lot of data is showing us that bigger impact on health status is that set of social determinants of health. As I said, the socioeconomic status of a family, their educational status, their availability of transportation so they can actually get to doctor's appointments, whether or not they're able to afford nutritious food, and so on. So that's the focus of this particular report, to try to better understand how nurses, whether they're working as a hospital-based nurse or working as a public health nurse or a school nurse, can really focus on those precursors to health that can have a much bigger impact, research is telling us, on health status of individuals.
So preventative behaviors would do a lot to mitigate some of these costs and our well-being in general. One thing that's relatively new to me, I've just seen this recently, is that some major medical centers are offering sort of a genetic testing or an analysis to give a sense of whether you're predisposed to a certain health problem.
Yes, and you will see more of that for sure. The federal government has a major initiative out of the National Institutes of Health on that front, and there are a lot of hospitals now that are doing exactly that kind of work. Actually, the beauty of much of that effort is that they can better calibrate treatments to individuals' genetic composition, if you will. They have a better sense, in other words, of what might work for one patient that may not work as well in treating, for example, lung cancer in another patient. So this is a whole new area of focus in healthcare, and it's a really exciting one. There's still a lot of work and a lot of research that's needed, but all of that is ongoing. And again, it's changing the face of medical and healthcare practice in really important ways. And I would say, and I think many others would too, in many cases, it's starting to save lives, where that would have been a challenge historically for lack of that information and the ability to really tailor treatments to the particular genetic code, if you will, of individuals. A lot more work needing to be done, but it's a very exciting avenue.
Wow, this is a brave new world we're in, isn't it?
It is. Exciting, too, yes.
All right. Well, it's always a pleasure to talk with you. Mary Wakefield is a doctor of nursing, former associate dean at UND and the director of what was the Rural Assistance Center, now the Rural Health Information Hub, served as acting deputy secretary of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, and currently a visiting distinguished professor at UND, Georgetown University, and the University of Texas at Austin, and let us not forget, one of five living legends, so named by the American Academy of Nursing. Congratulations, Mary.
Thanks so much, Doug. It's a pleasure to be with you today.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Josh Beauchet, realtor and broker with Hatch Realty, serving home buyers and sellers in the Fargo-Moorhead Metro, Grand Forks, Bismarck, Mandan, and Detroit Lakes area. Josh can be reached at 701-369-4839 or hatchrealty.com.
On the next APM Reports documentary.
The power that we are going to learn today, it's called picture power.
Picture power!
There's a theory about reading that was disproven decades ago by cognitive scientists. But kids are still being taught this way.
They would look at the beginning of the word, then guess the rest of it.
Listen for At a Loss for Words, What's Wrong with How Schools Teach Reading, from American Public Media.
APM Reports, this week's Prairie Public Presents, comes your way this afternoon at 5 Central, 4 Mountain.
Wherever you spend your morning, NPR's Morning Edition is there with you. Wherever the story takes place, NPR's Morning Edition connects it with you.
Dallas.
Des Moines.
Topeka.
Montana.
Cleveland.
San Francisco.
Denver.
Philadelphia.
Minneapolis.
Miami.
Colorado.
Washington.
You will own your morning, wherever you are, when you choose to spend tomorrow with Morning Edition from NPR News.
Beginning at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined now by Clay Jenkinson. He's well known to Prairie Public radio listeners and people all across the country for the Thomas Jefferson Hour, which he stars in weekly, Sundays at 11 Central here on Prairie Public. He's also a humanities scholar with the Theodore Roosevelt Center at Dickinson State University, and we're going to talk about the upcoming 14th annual Theodore Roosevelt Symposium. Thanks for being with us, Clay.
Oh, I'm delighted as usual. I can't believe it's 14 years, and each year we find a new topic.
And Rick Marshall joins us by phone from near Flint, Michigan. He's the author of Bully, The Life and Times of Theodore Roosevelt. He'll be presenting at the symposium The Great Heart and the Great War, a reassessment of TR's wartime years. Thank you for joining us, Rick.
I'm honored. Thank you.
Clay, let's start with this being the centennial year of Theodore Roosevelt's death. How would you describe the 14th annual symposium about his life and legacy?
Well, every year we step back and say, what should the theme be this year? Roosevelt and women, Roosevelt and Native Americans, Roosevelt and conservation, Roosevelt and World War I. Well, this year it was obvious. You know, Roosevelt died on January 6, 1919, just 60 years old. So this year, all over the country, centennial events have been scheduled, and we decided to do the legacy of Theodore Roosevelt. And, of course, to try to do the legacy of one of the most consequential presidents in our history in a couple of days is impossible. But we're making a run at it, and we have really a tremendous all-star cast. And I have to say, Rick Marshall is someone we've been wanting to get here for many years. He's the world's leading expert on Roosevelt and the political cartoon, and for Roosevelt, that's an important genre.
And Rick is a former political cartoonist himself. He'll be appearing again at the symposium, which runs September 12th through the 14th. That's a Thursday through Saturday at Dickinson State University. Rick, as Clay mentioned, you've written one of many books about his life. How would you describe your approach?
Well, with the book you referred to, Bully, The Life of T.R., it's a 100,000-word biography, pretty good treatment, I mean a full treatment. Gathered between 250 and 300 political cartoons of the day. People ask me, oh, you drew that many? No, I didn't draw any, but there are no photographs or anything. It's all political cartoons of the time. So it was kind of a unique way to approach his life and legacy, but also something that appeals to me as a cartoonist, but also as a historian, is the fact that cartoons are very unique. They have to be have universal appeal, be understood by the masses, be immediate, and make trenchant comments. And that winds up giving posterity great snapshots of issues, events, people, and larger meanings. So a book about his entire life had never been done, you know, with cartoons totally. So I was happy to do that, and I'm happy with the book. And we'll be displaying cartoons in some of the talks. One of mine, and I know you're going to get to this, but Clay and I are friendly sparring, but what we're calling a cartoon off, in which we'll be displaying for the audience our favorite, or what we think are the most significant cartoons, and the attendees will have a chance to chime in and vote and participate and ask questions. It's just going to be glorious. And well, great for people who can't read.
Well, the symposium runs full days, Friday and Saturday. Thursday evening, there's a welcome and a joint keynote that you just alluded to, Rick. You and Clay will be putting on the great Roosevelt cartoon off, and let's both of you talk about why Roosevelt was such a great subject for political cartoons.
Clay, you inhabit Roosevelt's personality sometimes. So
I wish I did. Well, Doug, the thing about Roosevelt is that he's his own caricature. When I started sort of looking at him, I thought, well, I'm not going to be one of those who lets him become a caricature. You know, this guy is always punching somebody out in a tavern or something. But Roosevelt caricatured himself. You know, when you think of political cartoonists, they look for some trait like President Obama's ears or Gerald Ford stumbling down the stairway of Air Force One. Or they're looking for something. Well, it's hard to do Calvin Coolidge and Warren Harding and even Gerald Ford, but But Roosevelt really lends himself to this. He was a soldier and an explorer and a big game hunter and a cowboy and a rancher and a statesman and a reformist and a writer and a family man and so on and so forth. And he was a much larger-than-life figure. He was like a walking caricature. And so cartoonists just love this about him because he was, as Rick said, a cartoon has to be compelling. It has to entertain in some sense, but it also has to signify. And so Roosevelt was just born to be cartooned. And Rick can probably tell us if anyone has been better cartooned, I don't think so, but if anyone has even been more cartooned than Roosevelt.
No, in each case, it's a count. Not better. That's objective, but not more often amongst American presidents or celebrities, and that is subjective. That's a fact. With other prominent presidents, even Lincoln and FDR, when cartoonists wanted to indicate the nation or even the administration's policy, they often drew Uncle Sam, or they would draw the Republican elephant or the Democrat donkey. But even though those figures lived during Roosevelt's era, Roosevelt was the one who embodied the administration and the nation. And it was a lot of it was his personality. He invited it. He was larger than life. And he was very conscious of the teeth and always smiling and gesticulating and bounding, not walking. And he invited that kind of attention, not ridicule. And there were anti-Roosevelt cartoons, of course, but reporters and cartoonists from Democrat papers very frequently were best friends of Roosevelt outside their assignments, and they just loved depicting it. It was a perfect storm. Also, at this time in American newspapers, photo engraving came in, so it was no longer onerous to have cartoons done on woodcuts or chalk plates or things like that. They could draw on paper with pen and ink, and the magic of photo engraving translated it to newspaper pages, and it was a similar thing with magazines, and movies were coming in. And so in the space of just a few years, Roosevelt burst on the public consciousness, not only for what he did, but who he was and able and the ability that technology provided to translate that to the people.
Well, how disruptive was he to the politics of his time? I mean, he seemed to be aware of his potential place in history even then and seemed to have a healthy ego. How disruptive was he, and what role did his personality play in doing that?
I think if he were anything less than your word disruptive, he would have been angry every night before going to bed. He knew what his task was. And one of the themes of my that I stated in Bully, and I'm not sure it's been stated elsewhere, in the way that Lincoln was the great emancipator, Roosevelt I call the great anticipator. And part of anticipating problems, addressing them, solving them, making the public aware, shaking up the establishment, had to do with a disruptive personality. He did not mind. He was very much a traditionalist socially. He was like a prissy Victorian and all like that. But when there were problems, he grabbed them by the shoulders and and shook the teeth out of them. And as an anticipator, we can never know this for sure, but it's fun to think about. There were a lot of problems and crises in America and around the world that might have happened except for his anticipation and his disruption and his problem solving.
He famously did his moonshot, which was the Panama Canal, and he was the first president, I think, to fly in an airplane, so he was into technology of his time.
And go down in a submarine.
Yeah. So why was he doing these things? To get attention or because he was consumed with interest about them?
Well, let me take a first stab at that, and I'll defer to Rick. But of course he wanted attention. He was Roosevelt. One of his guests at the White House said, you spend a couple of hours with him and then you go back to your hotel and wring his personality out of your clothes. He just couldn't help it. He just was that kind of a human being. But But I want to be really careful about tiptoeing up to the line here of disruptor. And, of course, we have a great disruptor in our national leadership at the moment. Roosevelt had a purpose. When he became president, and even before, he stepped back and said, what are the problems that need to get solved here? What's America's place in the world? How are we going to balance labor and capital? How are we going to absorb these new immigrants who don't speak English and are working in these cigar-rolling factories for pennies per day? How are we going to preserve our natural resources, because we appear to be sort of skimming the earth on some of these in some of these regards? How are we going to knit together the continent by finally getting an Isthmian canal, and so on? He went through all this long list in his mind of what are the problems we need to solve. And then he looked to the problem-solving entity, which is Congress, and he realized they're not going to do it. That's not the way they think. And besides, they're in an alliance with the wealthiest and most privileged Americans. So I'm going to have to do a lot of this by persuading, by using the bully pulpit, by being so charismatic and so compelling that that I bring people along with me, and using publicity in a really clever and intelligent way. And I'm going to have to do some things by executive order. I'm going to have to strong arm the Constitution a little to get some of this accomplished. And I know he knew that that was somewhat problematic, but he justified it. And his achievement is just staggering. But if he had waited for Congress to do all the things that he had in mind, it would have been a very long wait.
Clay Jenkinson and Rick Marshall will be participating in the 14th Annual Theodore Roosevelt Symposium. It comes up September 12th through the 14th at Dickinson State University. And I want to ask you both, you mentioned problematic, that word, Clay. What policies and, for that matter, public opinions of Theodore Roosevelt at his time would be problematic today?
Let me name one and then get out of the way for Rick. The Brownsville incident in 1906, when there was a riot probably by African-American soldiers who were stationed in Brownsville, Texas. It got out of hand. Some buildings were burned, and there were some injuries and a death. Roosevelt concluded that this was probably the responsibility of these African-American soldiers. And he really forced a judgment without getting all the evidence. And he, in a sense, knew that he was overreacting. But one of his weaknesses as a leader is he could not back down when he was wrong. And this is seen as a stain on his historical reputation. In fact, Richard Nixon later restored the dishonorable discharge to honorable of all the African-American soldiers who were condemned in that incident. So there's one.
Rick?
I have a point of view on that, which is that, as everyone from Senator Foraker from Ohio at the time, who came to the defense of the unit, to people, well, to everyone, 30 seconds ago, points out, which is correct, it was an African-American unit, and Roosevelt did seem to act hastily, but he challenged all the soldiers to come forward and name the guilty parties. Maybe no one knew. Maybe they did know. But he was relatively deliberate. And yes, he dishonorably discharged everyone. But I believe, and Clay, tell me if you disagree, that if they had been all white, he would have done the same thing. It was a matter of discipline and responsibility and not the color of the skin.
Yeah, probably. I think we could debate this for a long time, which, by the way, Doug, is the fun of it. At Dickinson State, at the TR Center, we have these symposia. We don't always agree. We disagree respectfully as good friends and playfully. We're going to have this cartoon off, and there will probably be some mock sparks that fly. But we don't try to celebrate Roosevelt or to denigrate him. We try to explore him, and so Rick and I will have a beer sometime during the symposium and come to blows over the Brownsville incident. But
I might even do that during my talk.
Oh, great.
Well, let me throw another hand grenade out there, because these days, when the political stuff gets moving, we hear a lot of isms. We hear liberalism, conservatism, progressivism. Roosevelt was famously, at least in sort of, I guess, the legacy that he left a progressive, at least of his time. How would you compare his political ideology to now?
Oh, I have ideas on that. And by the way, just to close out the last question, my talk is going to be about Roosevelt as virtual shadow president like we've never had in U.S. history during World War One. And I disagree. I regret many of the stands he took before America entered the war and while we were fighting it. I'm no fan of Wilson either. But my admiration for Roosevelt doesn't blind me to his shortcomings there, so I think I'm making that talk rather balanced in my eyes. As far as progressivism goes, you know, during the healthcare debate a few years ago, a lot of people on both sides, mostly, even President Obama said this, that Teddy Roosevelt was for national health insurance, et cetera, et cetera, and it's long overdue, and it's his legacy. Well, I've studied every speech from the New Nationalism speech through the Progressive Party platform, 1912, and he urged industrial insurance. But anyway, never a federal role or national insurance. So he's often called a progressive today, and by those who admire him and those who denigrate him, I think that his progressivism is the progressivism of the 21st century. And on the face of it, it can't be true because in 1912, for instance, there was Roosevelt the progressive and Wilson the progressive, very different agendas. And it was Wilson's that prevailed through Franklin Roosevelt and Kennedy and Johnson and, you know, through the years. And that is, in my mind, see what you think, Clay, but that strain of progressivism that was largely not Roosevelt's is what is today's progressivism.
Well, Doug, let me say this to that. This is a very, very complicated issue. Roosevelt became more progressive over time, but progressive, as Rick rightly says, meant something quite different than from what it may mean now. He was also an opportunist, and those things have to kind of be balanced in his political evolution. You know, he was listening to what was going on in the country. He felt deeply about some of these social concerns, environmental concerns. But I would call him a conservative progressive or a progressive conservative. These labels don't actually get us very far, but he did embrace the Progressive Party, the Bull Moose Party, in 1912, and wound up getting the largest third-party vote in the history of this country at 29%. And if it hadn't been for the fact that the primaries were just beginning, he probably would have re-won the presidency in that year.
Clay Jenkinson and Rick Marshall will be appearing at the 14th Annual Theodore Roosevelt Symposium, which is full of information about that very famous president who died 100 years ago this year. I want to end this discussion with something kind of fun here. What is your most obscure tidbit about Theodore Roosevelt, each one of you? I mean, you mentioned the submarine ride he went on, which would have been very daring and audacious at the time.
Rick, go ahead. You know more.
Oh, well, thanks. Gee, I mean, that's like, you know, naming your favorite child on public radio. Well, I can sum it up. I was tempted to quote this before, but at one point, and we're talking about airplane rides and submarine rides and his point-to-point walks through Rock Creek Park, in which never around but always over or through, and romping with his children every day at 5 o'clock, even if he had an appointment with President McKinley or some visiting dignitaries. I think, Clay, am I right, it was Jules Jusserand,
the French ambassador,
who said, you must remember the president is about six.
That's pretty good. How about you? How about you, Clay?
Pure fact, but I think it is. It gets to the nub of who he was as a person. Just vital.
Roosevelt is so colorful in so many ways. The list could be very, very long. I'm working up this cartoon off. One of mine is going to be about Roosevelt and spelling reform, and he somehow embraced this whole notion of spelling reform to simplify it. This has happened seven or eight times in American history, never with much success, and it all failed. Congress pushed back. The government printing office pushed back. He was widely ridiculed for this, and his wife Edith said, you know why he's doing this? It's because he can't spell.
All right. Clay Jenkinson right. will be the moderator. Rick Marshall will be speaking at the 14th Annual Theodore Roosevelt Symposium. Rick's topic will be Great Heart and the Great War, a reassessment of TR's wartime years. And Clay Jenkinson, of course, well known to our listeners. Thank you both for being with us today on Main Street.
Thank you.
Thank you. Great.
Today's programming is made possible in part by Jim and Sharon Geyer in celebration of their 50th wedding anniversary.
My name is Alejandra Castillo, and I am the CEO of the YWCA USA. I love NPR. First of all, it's the depth of the information, the complexity. The reporters do an amazing job, always turning the information, making sure that we're looking at it from so many different perspectives. So it nourishes me intellectually, but also there are some very beautiful human stories that really tug at the heart.
You can support the programs you love on Prairie Public by becoming a sustaining member. It's easy. Just go to prairiepublic.org, call 800-359-4145, or text the word support to 484848 and click on the link.
Listen to our podcast or a previous broadcast anytime, anywhere. In your home or on your phone, you can catch Main Street on any street. All day, all night, a friend in Fiji or your aunt in Vermont can tune into a show you just know they'd want to hear, or they can browse older shows for other topics of interest. Our app and archives are easy to find. They're right on Main Street, in the radio neighborhood at prairiepublic.org.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Last summer, the StoryCorps mobile booth came to Bismarck to collect oral histories. Today, we have two excerpts from those recording sessions. First, Loa Clement, who visited with her son, Jason. There's nothing in this world quite as strong as a mother's love, and that is also why mothers worry for their children.
I was thinking of complimenting you because I don't know that I do it enough. All your life you've seemed so selfless and so high-achieving. Actually, it concerns me a little bit that you're so selfless because I worry that you don't take consideration enough for yourself. It's like you would be the first to just give everything to the people around you, and I wish sometimes you hoarded a little more for yourself. Sometimes I wish you were just an ordinary little kid that we could correct instead of being so damn perfect all the time. When it came time for your senior year and the awards night, you were gone to some kind of competition. And they just had your younger sister, Angie, stay up on stage because your name was called over and over and over. National Merit Scholar, perfect score on your national Latin exam, valedictorian. Just achieving in every type of class in school, it seemed like the credit was all yours. We didn't inspire you or tell you or teach you what to take. You just...
You were extraordinarily loving parents. And
I think the death of your brother, Tom, one of the benefits of it is that it made us better parents, I think, to you guys. It taught us to appreciate you all so much, to know that it could change so rapidly. It's a fleeting thing, this little time we have. You know, one of my favorite things is going to bed a little bit ahead of you, which maybe means 2 a.m. instead of 3 or 4. But I like to go to bed and just lay there falling asleep, listening to all of you laugh. It is like about the best sound in the world.
Loa Clement with her son, Jason. Next, Karen Van Fossen visits the StoryCorps booth with her dear friend, Peter Huff. In this excerpt, we learn how Van Fossen came to pursue ministry.
How did professional ministry appear on your personal horizon?
What I like to say about how I decided to pursue ministry is I stopped trying not to. In many ways, you are a minister yourself, though don't wear that title. How did you find that path.
It was something I felt compelled to do from inside out. Now, you're in a particular tradition.
Yeah.
The Unitarian Universalist tradition. Why did you see that as a fruitful place to practice ministry?
Well, there was one particular day. I was walking through Bismarck, and it was a hard day. I was feeling pretty isolated. I was walking along, and it was kind of a warm day, and I don't usually walk on the busier streets when I'm walking, but for whatever reason, I turned down Divide Avenue. My heart was kind of on the ground as I walked, and there I saw on the lawn what I now know is called a wayside pulpit that has quotes on it. It's made of wood, and along the top, etched into the wood, was LGBTQ welcoming congregation and then rainbow colors. And I thought, welcoming is exactly what I'm looking for as a human being. And that, for me, marks the beginning of my maybe conversion to Unitarian Universalism. That sense of being clear about who we are and making a space for each of us to be alive.
Karen Van Fossen with her friend Peter Huff. StoryCorps is a national initiative to record and collect stories of everyday people. Our thanks to Basin Electric Power Cooperative of Bismarck for helping sponsor the StoryCorps visit to North Dakota. These excerpts were edited by Prairie Public.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Jade Presents, bringing comedian Louis Black to the Belle Mayhus Auditorium in Bismarck Saturday, September 14th, and to the Fargo Theater on Sunday, September 15th. Tickets are available now at jadepresents.com. Dickinson State University and the Theodore Roosevelt Center are proud to host the Theodore Roosevelt Symposium, September 12th through the 14th on the DSU campus. It's the 100th anniversary since TR's death. This year's symposium will explore the incredible legacy of Roosevelt as an explorer, writer, conservationist, and reformer, and how he helped create the modern presidency. Lectures and discussions will be in May Hall on the DSU campus, Thursday evening and all day Friday, with a field trip to Medora Saturday. Information and registration details can be found online at dickinsonstate.edu/TR.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming along with our members and other sources here on Prairie Public.
We hope you've enjoyed Main Street Weekend, and we invite you to join us for Main Street Weekdays at 3 Central, 2 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public. You can also listen live online and access our Main Street podcast anytime at prairiepublic.org. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your Sunday.